Acknowledge our international and our university and community sponsors, the University of Iowa's International Programs and the University of Iowa's Honors Program, and the Stanley U of I Foundation Support Organization for their financial support. And I thank today's very special financial sponsors, the Norton Fund. Now I am very pleased to introduce my friend Stella Birch Elias. She joined the University of Iowa College of Law faculty in 2012 after a two-year appointment as a Clemenko Fellow and lecturer on law at Harvard University Law School. In 2013, Professor Elias founded the College of Law's Advanced Immigration Law and Public Policy, and Policy Project, which enables law students to work on innovative legal policy projects for organizational clients in Iowa. And I have to tell you, they actually did a project for me last fall, filling in and letting us know what the immigration consequences were for different driving offenses that are prosecuted through the county attorney's office. And I'm very appreciative of that and the students' work. In 2015, she was awarded the James M. Murray Faculty Award, a university-wide award given each year to a tenure-track faculty member in recognition of outstanding teaching, assistance to students, exceptional research and writing, and dedication to the university and surrounding community. I must tell you that I know her originally from her providing assistance to Johnson County in helping us establish the Community ID program, after she had been instrumental in starting the first community ID program in New Haven, Connecticut, when she was a law student at Yale University. And we're very much appreciative of that. And mark down July 17th, because it will be our two-year anniversary for the community ID in Johnson County, and we're going to have a celebration that afternoon. Anyhow, getting back to Professor Elias, she also led students in providing research to a variety of different things, as I mentioned, the consequences for immigration on driving offenses. And all of her work that she has done with students and with the community are much appreciated. Prior to law school, Professor Elias served as a diplomat in the United Kingdom Foreign and Commonwealth Office. She clerked for Judge Stephen Reinhardt at the United States Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit. Now please join me in welcoming Stella Birch Elias.
Can everyone hear me? Yeah, wonderful. So thank you, Janet, for that really kind introduction. I teach both immigration law and policy and international law. And that's a reason why I'm particularly happy to have this opportunity to come here and talk to the Iowa City Foreign Relations Council. Immigration law is, of course, a part of international law, and international legal commitments are a part of our immigration law. The two are intertwined for a reason. Immigration law is inherently transnational. It involves people crossing borders, and it involves the lives of local communities that are affected by these international newcomers. So the laws affecting migration operate at an international level in international human rights law, international humanitarian law in particular, but also in our treaty commitments and in customary international law, what we call the law of nations, that has been a part of U.S. law since the founding of this great country. So today I'm going to talk about this intersection of immigration law and international law. And I'm gonna Here we go. So today, I'm going to talk about what the new Republican administration, led by President Donald J. Trump, has been up to in this highly sensitive and important national and international area of law. I'm only going to talk about immigration law and policy during the first 100 days of the Trump administration, not all of the other interesting things that have been occurring. If you have questions about that, maybe we can have some private conversations after the presentation. So I plan to do five things in my presentation today. First of all, I want to give you an overview of the newly announced policies governing the treatment of various immigrant communities. Second, I want to illustrate which immigrant communities have been affected by these new policies. Third, I want to outline briefly the legal challenges, the lawsuits that are underway across the country. Fourth, I want to discuss state and local responses and reactions to the new administration's immigration-related policies. And fifth and finally, I hope to explain the effect that these changes are having here today in our local community, our University of Iowa community, and our Iowa City and Johnson County communities. But let's begin with the new policies. So the new policies are all expressed in executive orders. For those of you who aren't lawyers, it's important to know that executive orders are not new laws, and they're not pieces of legislation. They're not regulations. They're decrees signed by the president with a stroke of his pen. And we have a really complex body of international and domestic laws that govern immigration, just some of which I've listed up here on the screen behind me. The most important of our domestic immigration laws is the Immigration and Nationality Act of 1952. To change that law, Congress would have to pass legislation, which it has singularly failed to do since the last time the INA, the Immigration and Nationality Act, was amended, which was way back in 1996. So in the absence of changes to the law itself, different administrations have pursued different policies. They've taken their own sub-regulatory actions to affect the lives of immigrant communities here in the United States. One of the most famous changes brought about by the Obama administration was the president's Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program, which many of you may have heard of, which helped dreamers, young people who were brought to the United States by their parents before the age of 16, to have authorization to work and to attend school. This program, as many of you will know, was broadly successful. President Obama attempted to amend that program and expand it and introduce a new program called Deferred Action for Parents of Americans, which was less successful, which was halted by a federal judge in Texas, and ultimately that halting was affirmed, at least preliminarily, by the United States Supreme Court. So all of this is to just explain that executive orders, the changes the new administration has brought about, are not laws. They are federal presidential decrees, which direct executive branch employees as to how they should use their resources to enforce the immigration laws already on the books. So far, there have been four executive orders. I have to tell you all, the Trump administration loves executive orders. There have been so many executive orders about so many different things. But four of those orders touch on immigration. So that's what I'm going to talk about today. And I've listed those four orders up here on the screen, but the text is kind of small, so I'm just going to tell you about them. The first one is the order enhancing public safety in the interior of the United States. The second is an order on border security and immigration enforcement improvements. The third is protecting the nation from foreign terrorist entry into the United States, also called the travel ban order. And the fourth is the Buy American and Hire American order. Let me tell you a little bit about them. So the first order, executive order number one, enhancing public safety in the interior of the United States. This order does three main things. First of all, it overturns the Obama administration and the predecessor administrations, quite frankly, enforcement priorities. What this means is all administrations have had policies about how they're going to enforce immigration laws. In immigration law, as in many other areas of the law, there's a big difference between the law as enforced and the law on the books. So the law on the books might say you can't drive above 30 miles an hour. The law as enforced means you're not going to get pulled over if you're doing 32 miles an hour, but you may well be pulled over if you're doing 50 miles an hour. And in immigration law, a very similar approach has been taken. So under the Obama administration, there were a system of priorities for the arrest and ultimate deportation of immigrants, with immigrants who committed criminal offenses being right at the top of the list, along with anyone suspected of involvement in terrorism. The new executive order ripped up and threw away those priorities. And instead, the new executive order says that anyone who has committed an act that could constitute a chargeable offence. Not anyone who's been convicted, not anyone with a record, but anyone who's committed an act that could be a chargeable offence is a priority for deportation. And it also says that anyone in the judgment of any immigration officer who that immigration officer individually believes might pose a risk to public safety or national security can be subject to deportation. What this means really for all of us, especially for Janet and her colleagues, is that all bets are off as to how immigration laws are going to be enforced. Under the new order, all immigration officers and all police officers operating as deputized immigration authority officers have absolute discretion in the way that they enforce immigration laws. When they arrest and detain people, they get to choose. There's no guidance for them from the government on prioritizing people who have committed serious crimes. There's no guidance on when and how these laws should be enforced. They've just been given really broad discretion to do so. So that's the first thing this order does. The second thing that it does is it encourages federal-state cooperation in immigration enforcement. Section 287G of the Immigration and Nationality Act allows states and localities to enter into agreement with the federal government, saying that that local law enforcement officers, local police officers, sheriff's deputies will act as deputized immigration agents. And this order just says we want to do more of that. And then finally, and for me, most worryingly, this order suggests ways in which to punish so-called sanctuary cities. The order instructs the federal government to issue a weekly blacklist naming immigrants who have been charged with crimes or listing crimes that may have been committed by immigrants, to name and shame both the immigrants and the communities in which they live if those communities are regarded as sanctuary jurisdictions. The text of the order says, to better inform the public regarding the public safety threats associated with sanctuary jurisdictions, the Secretary of Homeland Security shall utilize the Decline Detainer Outcome Report or its equivalent and on a weekly basis make public a comprehensive list of criminal actions committed by aliens and any jurisdiction that ignored or otherwise failed to honor any detainers. In other words, someone in the federal government is going to be responsible every week for doing a roundup, a sort of scarlet letter of where in the country crimes might have been committed by immigrants and which jurisdictions, places like Iowa City and Johnson County, have been supporting them by not complying with whatever the federal government's immigration enforcement scheme is at that time. So that's quite worrying, really, if you're concerned about the relationship between states and localities, their independence and their communities, that the federal government is now going to be keeping a list and sort of highlighting and shaming, naming and shaming places that they believe are not compliant. Nowhere in the order does it say what a sanctuary jurisdiction is. That's up to federal government officials to decide. If a federal government official decides we live in a sanctuary city, we live in a sanctuary city, even if we haven't decided that ourselves as a community. So that's the first order. The second order is on border security and immigration enforcement. Let me call my screen back. The second order is the Build the Wall order. We all, during the campaign, heard candidate Trump talk about building his wall. This is the order to build a wall. Of course, he can say we're going to build a wall, but he needs Congress to provide him with the money, and they haven't done that so far, which is why we're now hearing it might be a fence. But nonetheless, the order says we'll build a wall. The order also says we'll build more prisons. We'll build more facilities, more detention facilities along the southwest border to detain people there. And the order also provides for less process for immigrants who are detained around the border, more expedited removal, quick removal without a full hearing in front of an immigration judge, and higher standards for people who claim to be fleeing persecution. So people who've experienced persecution or have a fear of future persecution on account of their race, their religion, their nationality, their political opinion, their membership in a particular social group, those people now have a higher barrier to get over when making that claim that they have a credible fear of harm in their country of origin. So that's the second order. The third order, you have to have been living under a rock to have missed the third order. The third order is the order protecting the nation from foreign terrorist entry into the United States. This affects three categories of people. Anyone in the United States Refugee Assistance Program, anyone coming to the U.S. as a refugee, anyone from Iran, Somalia, Syria, Sudan, or Yemen. There was an earlier version of this order that also included Iraqi nationals, but after lobbying from the Iraqi government about highlighting the close relationship between the regime that the US, the UK, and allies established in Iraq, Iraq was removed from the list of bad actors, and Iraqi citizens are still able to enter the US, unless they're refugees. If they're refugees, they're not able to. But anyone from these named countries, Iran, Somalia, Syria, Sudan, or Yemen, apart from green card holders who have already been living here in the United States, if you're a national of one of these countries and you're a lawful permanent resident, you have a green card, you live here, you're okay. If you're any other category of person, if you're a student at the University of Iowa, if you're a scholar at the University of Iowa, if you're working for ACT or any other big corporation here in Iowa, if you have family members here and you want a visa to come join your family member, if you're in any of those categories and you're from those countries, you're barred from entry right now. Finally, there's a provision of this particular executive order that suspends the visa interview waiver program. It used to be for people who were in the United States for a while, who needed to renew their visas. If they've been here without problem, they didn't have to attend an in-person interview in their country of origin. We see this at the university. A lot of our Chinese students who are here at the business school or the law school need to renew their visas in this way. And this new program has suspended that interview process, which just means they have a much longer wait to renew their visas now. So that's where we stand with this order today. As you all know, there have been two iterations of it. The first one that was subject to a tremendous amount of legal challenge, the second revised one that attempted to deal with some of the issues that were raised in the litigation. The refugee admissions program is still suspended. The suspension was to last from 120 days from March 6th, the date of the new order. The visa interview waiver program is still suspended, and nationals of Iran, Somalia, Syria, Sudan, and Yemen are barred from entering the US, apart from green card holders who already live here. And then the final order is the Buy American and Hire American order of April 18th, 2017. And this order doesn't say much about immigration, and what it says is a little bit vague, but it has people who deal with the employment of immigrants rather worried. So what the order says is that as soon as possible, the Attorney General, the Secretary of Labor, and the Secretary of Homeland Security will propose new rules and issue new guidance to change the way that employment visas are issued, to ensure there's more due diligence of any application from anyone for a visa, and to change the way that H-1B visas are issued. What does this mean? None of us know. International students here at the University of Iowa are able, after they complete their studies, to stay for an extra year doing something called optional practical training. We've heard suggestions that the period of optional practical training, which is currently a year, might be reduced to as little as 30 days. We're just waiting to see what will happen. I want to say, if you look at these four executive orders, there is a glaring absence in one category of immigrants, and that's dreamers, young people who came here as children under the age of 16 with their parents, which is kind of ironic because all of the attempts at comprehensive immigration reform since 1996 have been geared towards helping these young people one way or another. Many of the failed acts in Congress have been designed to help dreamers. There was a draft order affecting dreamers that was circulated in January at the same time as the first two orders. And the text of that order suggests that it would let the Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals program expire, leaving the young people with no right to work, no right to driver's licenses, and accruing what we call unlawful presence, which is time when they're not authorized to be here in the United States. But interestingly, although all of us in the immigration law community have seen the draft, it hasn't been signed by the president, it hasn't been published in the Federal Register. So with respect to that, we're still waiting to see what will happen. Which brings me to my point of which communities are therefore affected. We've got these four executive orders. Who's affected by them? So with all the changes we've seen over the last 100 days, this is really quite a pressing question. And as I hope my quick overview of the content of the orders has shown, it's probably easier to guess who's not affected. I sat down to try and make a list of who is affected by the new regime. And essentially, it's every kind of immigrant you could imagine. It's refugees and asylum seekers. It's international students and scholars. It's employment visa holders. It's family-based visa holders. With the earlier version of the travel ban, it's green card holders, it's undocumented immigrants and lawfully documented immigrants. It can even be US citizens, you know, children of undocumented parents or people who've naturalized while some other members of their family haven't naturalized. The breadth of these changes are sweeping. It affects everyone. You know, you might think this picture, which is a picture of refugees in the Mediterranean, is designed to suggest refugees are affected. I like to think it's designed to show that we are all in the same boat. And because of this, we've seen a wide range of responses from a wide range of people. Some of the people who have responded to these executive orders are in the federal government, like Acting Attorney General Sally Yates, who was dismissed, as you might remember, by President Trump after she refused to defend the travel ban in federal court. Some of these people are in state government, like Governor Abbott of Texas, who supports the executive orders and just signed into law an anti-sanctuary city bill. Some people, like Governor Brown of California, are opposed and are supporting their own statewide sanctuary movement. Some people are in local government, like our very own Johnson County Board of Supervisors, who issued a statement in response to the executive orders underscoring that immigrants are welcome in our community. And some responses have been by nonprofit organizations and other allies of immigrant communities. But one of the most important arenas in which we've seen these responses are the federal courts, where a number of legal challenges have been filed. And I have to tell you, it warms the cockles of my cold, cold loyally heart to see my friends and colleagues litigating these cases. So there are dozens of ongoing cases and even more closed cases challenging the various executive orders. I've just listed a few on the screen here. But if you'd like a comprehensive list, let me know. I've also put a web link at the bottom, but it's quite difficult for everyone to see, I suspect, showing where you can find all of the papers from all of these cases, which have been consolidated together on one blog. So far, there have been challenges to the first three executive orders I told you about. First of all, there have been challenges to the travel bans, which have perhaps been the most visible pieces of litigation. So immediately after the refugee travel bans went into effect, a coalition of nonprofit organizations, including law school clinics, the Iraqi Refugee Assistance Project, the National Immigration Law Council, the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project, the Legal Aid Justice Center, they all came together to organize to get people out of detention. So they filed what we call habeas corpus actions, asking government to produce the bodies of the people who were held in detention. And so habeas corpus cases were filed across the country, and my little map sort of charts where they are. They were filed in New York, Washington, Boston, Atlanta, Dallas, Chicago. There are individual cases in Virginia, Massachusetts, and these were all designed to help individual immigrants. There were also legal challenges brought by the states themselves. So the state of Washington sued the president, Washington versus Trump. The state of Hawaii sued the president, Hawaii versus Trump. And in these cases, the states tried to argue that these travel bans were unconstitutional. Just this week at the United States Court of Appeal for the Fourth Circuit, in International Refugee Assistance Project versus Trump, lawyers on behalf of that nonprofit and its allies argued that the entire ban was unconstitutional. It violated the Establishment Clause of the Constitution. It violated the Fifth Amendment. It violated the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, and it violated the anti-discrimination provisions of our Immigration and Nationality Act and our Refugee Act. So those are the challenges just to the travel ban. There are also challenges to the interior enforcement order, largely brought by cities that claim that their 10th Amendment rights, the 10th Amendment reserves to the states all the powers not expressly given to the federal government. And so places like the city and county of San Francisco and the city of Chelsea in Massachusetts have argued that this new order requiring them to cooperate with the federal government to deport immigrants living in their communities, this new order is unconstitutional. And finally, we're even beginning to see legal challenges to the border enforcement order, specifically the provisions about building the wall. So in April 2017, the Center for Biological Diversity, an environmental group, not an immigration group, an environmental group joined together with a representative in the House of Representatives, the ranking Democratic member on the House Committee on Natural Resources, to file suit in federal court saying that building the wall would destroy the natural environment. So if you care about international environmental law. I tell you, international law right now has got everything for you. It's got human rights law, it's got constitutional law, it's even got international environmental law designed to protect endangered species like jaguars and sonoran pronghorns. I didn't know what that was until I did this presentation. And ocelots, all sorts of creatures, all sorts of flora and fauna along the border will potentially be disrupted by this executive order. In addition to the lawsuits, there's also been a lot of lawmaking. So state and local governments have responded in opposition to the administration's new policies in a variety of different ways. So we've seen non-cooperation at the state level. I've got two examples from just the last couple of weeks, which I've put up on the board for you. The first is the California Values Act, SB 54, which is currently pending before the state legislature in California, which makes the state of California a sanctuary state. Well, what does that mean? It means that state and local law enforcement agencies throughout California, including school police and security departments, are prohibited from using their resources to investigate, interrogate, detain, detect, or arrest people for immigration enforcement purposes. It also requires all public schools, public libraries, health facilities operated by the state, and courthouses to implement a policy prohibiting immigration and customs enforcement from coming in and arresting people. This is particularly an issue in California, where federal officers have been turning up at state courthouses and arresting people waiting outside traffic court. They've been looking and seeing and believing they have probable cause based on people's Latino ancestry to arrest and detain them. As you might imagine, in California, where the big U.S. citizen Latino communities, this has been an initiative that has had mixed results. So that's the California Values Act. There's also in New York just recently been something called the New York Immigrant Family Unity Project, which is the first project in the nation to fund defense in immigration court for immigrants facing deportation. So right now, you have the right to consult with an attorney if you find yourself placed in removal proceedings, deportation proceedings in immigration court, but you don't have a right to a publicly funded lawyer. You can pay for your own lawyer, but it's not like criminal law where there's a public defender system, except in the state of New York, where a bunch of nonprofits, together with the state legislature and Mayor de Blasio, have come together and have agreed to fund deportation defense just like a public defender system. And in fact, the deportation defense is being run out of the Bronx defenders and the Brooklyn defenders, the people providing that criminal defense work. So that's what's happening at the state level. At the local level, there's a long history of non-cooperation by cities and counties with the federal government in this area. There are don't ask, don't tell law enforcement general orders. This means you can approach a police officer to report a crime or for some other safety concern. And if you don't tell them about your immigration status, they can't ask about your immigration status. And a number of these new policies have been promulgated in areas that didn't have them before. There are anti-detainer policies by county jails. An immigration detainer is a request by the federal government that when a person is released from jail, because they've served their time for a criminal charge, they then be immediately arrested and held until immigration authorities can come and pick them up. And a number of cities and counties, ranging from New Orleans to the state of Alaska, have said they're not going to honor these requests because they're not required to. There's a long string of cases that were litigated on the West Coast saying you don't have to agree to this request. It's just a request. The federal government can't force a city or can't force a county to do anything it doesn't want to do. And then, of course, there are sanctuary ordinances and welcoming city initiatives, a variety of different ways in which county and city government officials can say, we are an inclusive community. Immigrants are welcome here. We're not going to cooperate with the federal government. We're going to allow immigrants to access our libraries and our parks and to participate fully in our community. So those are the kinds of initiatives we're seeing to push back against the executive orders. But that's not the full story, because we're also seeing initiatives that support the executive orders. Here are two examples, one from Texas and one from right here in Iowa. So the Texas example is the Texas Anti-Sanctuary Cities and Campuses Act. SB 4, which Governor Abbott just signed into law this week. So the bill, the law now, requires local government entities and law enforcement officials to comply with any requests from the federal government pertaining to immigration. And it creates criminal penalties for entities that don't enforce the law. In other words, if you're a city attorney, if you're a county attorney, and you're not cooperating with ICE, you can face criminal penalties under Texas law. Governor Abbott, introducing this law, said, "As governor, my top priority is public safety, and this bill furthers that objective by keeping dangerous criminals off our streets." He says, "With this bill, we are doing away with those that seek to promote lawlessness in Texas." As a result of this bill now in Texas, there's a civil penalty of up to $25,500 for each day a city is in non-compliance. It's a Class A misdemeanor for a sheriff, a chief of police, or a constable to not respond and honor detainer requests. And any elected or appointed official who doesn't comply can be removed from office. It's a pretty extreme bill. Here in Iowa, our own versions, a Senate File 481, which passed the Senate on April 12th, but has died a quiet death in the House during this legislative session, didn't go quite as far, but it intended to bar any locality within Iowa from receiving state funding if it didn't cooperate with ICE. It required Iowa law enforcement agencies to comply with federal immigration detainer requests for people in their custody, and it prohibited local governments from discouraging local law enforcement officers or others from activities designed to enforce the immigration laws. Now, as I say, the bill has died a quiet death in the House in that it didn't reach the floor for a vote during the current legislative session, but the possibility remains that it will be revived come the fall. So there's that. There are also a variety of other ways in which local governments have cooperated with the executive orders. There are these 287G agreements under the authorized by the Immigration and Nationality Act, whereby local police officers are deputized by the immigration authorities. There are policies pro-detainer at the local level, and there are so-called illegal immigrant relief acts, local ordinances that limit the leasing of property to immigrants, the granting of licenses to do a variety of activities in a locality. These illegal immigrant relief acts were subject to extensive litigation in the mid-2000s and were overwhelmingly found to be unconstitutional in Pennsylvania, in Texas, and in Nebraska. But they are rearing their ugly heads again as the executive orders go into effect. So this is what's been going on at the national, state, and local level during the first 100 days of the Trump administration, which leads me to my final point, which is how does this affect us today in our community? Well, you're all here today because you care about international law, and I suspect you care about foreigners, folks like me, and other international members of our local community. During my 5 years here at the University of Iowa, I've got to know this community pretty well. And in my experience talking with our students, with my colleagues, and with my neighbors over the last 100 days, my experience suggests to me that the new policies, even though they are not law, are nonetheless affecting us all quite profoundly. So here at the university, we have international students and scholars who haven't been able to obtain visas to attend school. In my department at the College of Law, we have an international scholar from Iran who was coming to do some really fascinating research who can't leave the country and can't come and join us. We have students across the university, including students I teach every day, from the travel ban countries who haven't been able to go home, who haven't been able to attend weddings or funerals, who haven't been able to see their parents, and whose parents can't come for graduation this weekend, which is very sad. We also have students from other countries, not from the countries listed on the travel ban, who are now wary of traveling nonetheless because they don't want that experience of crossing a border and being interviewed or possibly detained by the authorities. And then finally, we have our Dreamers, our DACA recipient students who've lived in the U.S. in one case I know of, since this person was 8 months old, but who've lived in the U.S. functionally their entire lives, who now worry about what will happen with them, who know that their status is really fragile, who worry they'll be deported, and who worry a lot about their family members. So that's just in the university. In Iowa City, we have seen an uptick in people afraid to approach the police for assistance. particularly to report crimes, despite assurances from the Iowa City Police Department that they won't be penalized for doing so. We've met with many, many immigrant parents, both undocumented immigrants and also documented immigrants here with authorization, who are nonetheless worried about their setting up powers of attorney for their children because they fear that they might just one day be arrested by the authorities for reasons unknown to them and deported. We have immigrants who feel vulnerable because of their race, their ethnicity, the languages they speak, their religion, who, even though they've lived here for many years, are consolidating assets and selling up and moving money home just in case something happens to them. And we have undocumented immigrants and low-income migrant workers who are afraid to use government services in case this is interpreted as them being a public charge. Because on the campaign trail, President Trump talked about this a lot. So they're now worried about going to see the doctor. We hear horror stories of people who are afraid to go to the hospital. We even hear about parents of U.S. citizen children who tell their kids, don't eat sandwiches at school. Don't, you know, use any government resources because this could be used against us. And we've all read in our local papers about incidents of abuse and bullying of immigrants and first-generation Americans in our local schools, and that's here in Iowa City. Based on everything I've heard, our surrounding communities in Johnson County, Coralville, North Liberty, Solon, Hills, Lone Tree, are perceived as less inclusive than Iowa City. And the more isolated immigrant communities in those towns are, by all accounts, faring even worse than we are here. And so that's where we are today. So to sum up, the Trump administration hasn't changed the immigration laws. It can't. It can't amend the Immigration and Nationality Act without Congress, and it can't issue new regulations without notice and comment. But what it has done is issue presidential decrees called executive orders, changing how immigration laws are interpreted and enforced by the federal government. These changes have already been so far-reaching, and they have the potential to be even more so. Ramping up border enforcement, changing the deportation priorities, banning whole classes of immigrants, people from certain places, from entering the country, and changing employment opportunities for students who are here and immigrants who want to come here to work. And these new policies have the power to affect everyone. International students and scholars, family-based immigrants, employment-based immigrants, refugees and asylum seekers, people of all religious backgrounds, people of all nationalities, people of all ethnicities, seniors, adults and children. And these new policies have created a variety of responses. They've created federal lawsuits, they've created state legislation, they've created local ordinances. And these new policies have already had a tangible effect right here in our community. And I think it's worth underscoring that this effect is not necessarily because of the law, but rather because of the climate that's built up around the law. A climate of fear of the other, fear of foreign people, international people, fear of the unknown, and a culture of insularity. And so one of the very best responses is events like today, where we've all gathered together to talk about the international community and break bread with one another and learn more. So it's really been a privilege to have the opportunity to talk to you about these changes. Thank you.
How is it constitutional to govern by executive order bypassing the legislature? What are the limits, and what can be done to stop Trump from using these orders?
Well, there is a 4-credit constitutional law class at the University of Iowa that answers those questions in some detail. The short answer is it's the duty of the president to take care to enforce the laws. And the argument that is always made for executive orders is that they're not creating new laws. They're setting priorities for the operationalization, to invent a word, they're setting priorities for how the federal government will enforce the laws that are on the books. And so each provision of an executive order should be designed to implement existing law, allocate resources to implement existing laws. And of course, the challenge that we see to the current executive orders, including the executive orders dealing with immigration, is one of overreach, that they're not just interpreting the existing provisions of the Immigration and Nationality Act, they're in fact going beyond them and governing by executive order rather than in accordance with the laws. So that's a great question. The answer is you can't bypass the legislature, which is what these lawsuits are trying to point out.
How how will these executive orders affect the international relationships with other countries?
This is such a great question. This is what I've been talking about all semester with the students in my Foundations of International Law class. The short answer is we don't yet know. So the U.S. has a number of international legal commitments, not just commitments which I listed on the board to do with migrant labor and refugees, but also commitments like the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. The U.S. is a signatory to the U.N. Charter. All of these international legal provisions bind us to treat the people within our borders fairly and in a non-discriminatory way. And many of the arguments leveled against these executive orders is that they discriminate on the basis of race, religion, nationality, political perspective. So it remains to be seen. We've already, we've already heard about conversations the president has had with heads of state in other nations. The difficult telephone conversation with the Australian Prime Minister, where the Australian Prime Minister, Australia, by the way, a country not known for its fine treatment of refugees, telling him that he can't ban all refugees from entry to the United States. There's also the question of the countries where refugee camps are located, who are facing a tremendous fiscal burden supporting the refugees in place there, who have already been cleared after 2 years of vetting to come to the United States. And so by failing to accept them, the US is offloading that financial responsibility to the already strained resources of those countries. And then we've read about and heard about the effect that this has had on diplomatic relations. My old job, diplomatic relations with the United Kingdom appear to be fine. Diplomatic relations with Mexico and Latin American nations appears to be strained, as nationals of those countries seem to be singled out right now, especially with the interior enforcement and border enforcement rules. So as a person who writes and thinks a lot about international law, this is a very uncertain time for us. And it remains to be seen how long-standing the effect will be of these policies. I think we're only seeing the beginning right now.
This seems like a good follow-up to something you just said. In order for illegal immigrants to be deported to Mexico, Mexico has to agree to take them. How likely is it for Mexico, I would say other countries as well, to refuse to take deported immigrants, and how could this affect Trump's agenda?
Well, this is an interesting question. So if you are a national of a country, you have a right to enter your country, right? If you have a passport, you know, your passport says you are entitled to enter freely. So if you're a US citizen and you've been overseas, you have a right to enter the United States. If you're a Mexican citizen or a Salvadoran citizen or a Guatemalan citizen, you have a right to enter your country of origin. It's more complicated when you're dealing with people who are nationals of one country and the administration is trying to remove them, deport them to a third country. Third countries can refuse to take you. So if you have an Iranian citizen who you're trying to remove, but you can't send them back to Iran because of human rights abuses, and the government decides to deport them to Jordan, the government of Jordan can refuse to take them. But as a principle of international law, it would be impossible for the Mexican government to deny entry to its citizens who have a valid claim of citizenship. Now, it may well be that for some reason or another, they might claim that they don't. But I think the question beyond that technical issue gets at something much deeper, which is that in order for increased immigration enforcement to work, there has to be close cooperation between the United States and the countries to which it is returning people. President Obama deported more immigrants than any other president in history. In fact, the Obama administration deported during the 8 years that Obama was in office, more immigrants than had been deported from the passage of the INA in 1952 until the date President Obama took office. So hundreds of thousands of immigrants. But this worked because there were very clear enforcement priorities, people with criminal histories and criminal records, not family members, not people who have been embedded in communities for a very long time, with one or two exceptions based on criminal activity. And for that reason, the world community believed that the administration of the United States was acting in good faith. And good faith in diplomacy buys you a lot of opportunity. I hesitate to say that good faith has been lost, but it has been compromised by recent actions, which mean that the process may happen, but there will be bureaucratic hurdles and it will take longer. And of course, as it takes longer, people will be held in detention at the US taxpayers' expense for longer periods of time. And so it will perhaps ultimately cost us more than it previously did.
Okay, put on your judicial cap now, because this question is, what do you think will happen with the travel ban?
If I knew the answer to that question, I would be charging people so much money. So this week, the United States Court of Appeal for the Fourth Circuit heard IRAP versus Trump, the International Refugee Assistance Program versus Trump case, arguing that the travel ban was unconstitutional. We have seen the first version of the travel ban was preliminarily enjoined, allowing refugees who have been issued visas to enter the country. My take on the ban, my personal take, it's just my view, is that it's unconstitutional because it's impermissibly broad. So the federal government does absolutely have the right to set immigration priorities, and the government has the right to determine the threat level from different nations. The government has the right to holistically examine every application from a refugee or from any individual who seeks to enter the United States. We live in a world of sovereign nations who have the right to control their borders. And as a former Foreign Service officer, I've played my own role in doing that. So I'm in favor of that. But the way that the original travel ban was so sloppily drafted, and it created chaos because people were traveling at the time it went into effect, left somewhere thinking they had a valid visa, and were turned away at the border. To get around that, in the period between the first and the second travel ban, no new visas were issued. So there were no people left with travel authorization who could travel. So as a practical matter, until embassies start issuing visas again, the travel ban will remain in operation. But I do suspect that the federal courts will say this is just too broad. It discriminates on the basis of national origin. It discriminates on the basis of religion. And we live in a country where those things are protected by the Constitution and by federal statute, including the statute governing migration. So I believe that that federal courts will step in.
This one says, I have heard that churches, schools, hospitals are still considered sensitive areas. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so there's a long, for those of you who don't know about this, there's a long-standing practice. It doesn't appear in the law anymore. It doesn't appear in regulation. A long-standing practice of the old INS back before 2001 and modern immigration customs and enforcement to not arrest people for immigration violations in sensitive areas. In public schools, or private schools, but in public schools, in hospitals, and churches, these were no-go areas. That seems to have changed somewhat, in as much as we're now seeing immigration and customs officers appearing in courthouses. We're now reading reports of immigration and customs enforcement officers not entering schools, but being in the vicinity of schools. So this is very much a moving target. These areas have been recognized as sensitive and where it's inappropriate to enforce the immigration laws and arrest people for immigration violations, but they're not legally protected areas. I do know that immigrants' rights organizations like the National, the American Immigration Council and the ACLU's Immigrants' Rights Project are collecting stories of people of threatening activity by immigration officers in these sensitive areas. So I expect we'll see a lawsuit about this sometime soon. As soon as the ACLU starts collecting information, you know a lawsuit is coming. So I suspect this is something that we'll actually see litigated to try and get a read on it. But it's not a violation of the law because there's no regulatory protection or statutory protection of these areas. It's just a long-standing practice to honor faith communities and medical professionals and educators, basically, and the communities that they serve.
Okay, Do you expect any changes? Whoops. Any changes to the marriage visas granted to immigrants?
Oh, so that's a great question, right? Under the law right now, if you are a non-citizen and you marry a U.S. citizen, you become an immediate relative of a U.S. citizen, and through that marriage, you're entitled to obtain a green card. And right now, if you are a national of Iran, of Yemen, of Somalia, of Sudan, and you marry a U.S. citizen, you are not entitled to a green card because there's a ban on issuing a visa to you. So people are already affected. People are already affected. If you were already married and you already have a green card, you're just fine. And version 2.0 is not supposed to interfere with the green card system. But as a practical matter, embassies overseas are not interviewing nationals of these countries and not issuing their original travel documents. It remains to be seen what will happen to people with other family-based visas, right? Because marriage is not the only way to recognize family relationships in immigration law. You can sponsor your parent if you're over 21 years of age. You can sponsor your children. You can sponsor your adult children. If you're a green card holder, you can sponsor your spouse. You know, so there are a variety of different family-based relationships, and the American Immigration and Nationality Act, unlike other countries' immigration laws, really privileges family relationships. The family is most important in immigration law. And so family relationships are kind of the holy grail of the immigration law, and legislators have been very loath to mess with that over the years. The most recent attempt at comprehensive immigration reform tried to remove the sibling preference. Siblings, because you could sponsor your brother. I could, for example, sponsor my brother or sister if they were interested in coming to the US, which, to be honest, they're not these days. But if they were interested, my husband and I, we could sponsor them for a visa. Most recently, when they've talked about reforming the Immigration and Nationality Act, removing that sibling visa opportunity is the only way they've talked about changing it. But all bets are off, really, as to what might happen as the new administration and the new Congress move forward.
I wanted to follow up on something else that you just said, too. If there are no visas being issued in other countries for people to come here, so basically you said it's like, even though it's been stayed, it still is not working to try to get people here. The travel ban is still really in effect. Is that accurate?
There's a hiatus now, and I understand. If you're a U.S. consular officer working at an embassy overseas, you don't want to be the person who makes that judgment call who ends up with somebody on a plane. And airlines have been enforcing the laws themselves. You may remember when the travel ban was first introduced. You know, airlines wouldn't allow nationals of these countries to board their planes. So in addition to the question of visa issuance, there's also the question of people just physically getting here if they fall into any of these categories. And the reason for that is that under the common carrier rules, if an airline brings a person here who's turned away, they then have to pay to fly them back. So they don't want to take that financial risk on people on bringing them here.
Okay, I've been told I only have 3 minutes left, so can you address, we'll have to make this quick. Can you address parallel legislation emerging regarding criminalization of protests as people causing riots or threatening and endangering property for expressing rights to assemble and to free speech?
In 3 minutes. There is a very worrying trend that we are seeing in immigration law, in human rights discourse, in First Amendment related legal claims, and that is the stifling of dissent. One of the things I have loved about coming to Iowa, which before I came to Iowa, it will shock you, I didn't know much about Iowa. But one of the things I've really valued about our community is the exchange of ideas at fora like this. And I feel deeply concerned on a personal level, never mind as a lawyer, but on a personal level about any initiatives designed to stifle people's voices. And we've seen that. We see that in the immigration context with these anti-sanctuary bills that penalize county officials for speaking out, that criminalize, that invoke criminal fines for speaking on behalf of immigration communities and stopping immigration enforcement. And so to the extent that there's a concern about more broad measures to limit or criminalize or otherwise penalize speech, I fear that these anti-sanctuary bills are the thin end of the wedge. And I really hope that we don't see more initiatives building on the smaller precedent of these anti-sanctuary bills that explode into the kind of situation raised by the question.
Well, we now conclude our program and want to give a big thank you to Stella Birch Elias for her presentation. I also thank our sponsors, the University of Iowa's International Programs, the University of Iowa's Honors Program, and the Stanley U of I Foundation Support Organization for their generous support. And we also thank today's special financial sponsor, the Norton Fund. And we thank City Channel 4 for making our programs available to viewing audiences. And Stella, as a small token of our appreciation, we are giving you the highly coveted Iowa City Foreign Relations Council mug and hope you enjoy it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for joining us, and we are adjourned.